Thanks so much for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time for a look at your technology issues. We'll talk about privacy and security today, including doorbell cameras, with our guest, Jesse LeGru, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He's also a volunteer handler for the SANS Internet Storm Center. Today, Jesse is going to cover news about push notification privacy. We'll talk about which Facebook settings you should take a second look at. And, of course, we'll take your questions as well. What do you have in the way of questions about making sure your technology is safe and secure? Let us know your other computer problems as well. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Jesse LeGru, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Let's start by talking about doorbell cameras. First, for those who aren't familiar with them, maybe you could describe them and what their capabilities are.
Yeah, most video doorbell cameras, they were really meant to, I guess we look at it kind of a older technology. You have a door, somebody knocks, they ring the doorbell. You might have a little eyesight in the middle of the door where you can actually just take a look on who's outside before you decide to answer it. Either it's somebody you know, or maybe you're trying to filter, you know, solicitors that are going to ask questions and maybe you don't want to talk to them. The video doorbell gives kind of a very similar capability, but also greatly expanded, where you can see who's outside of your door, but not necessarily just when people knock or somebody rings the doorbell. But it does allow you, if you're, you know, away on vacation, if you're not physically home, you can actually get notified for somebody who is at your door ringing the bell, and could give you actually additional options if you have other hardware, to maybe even let them in to actually talk to them and interact in a way that otherwise isn't possible. So you get a lot of great features to talk to people and interact with people that might be right outside your home with this little video doorbell.
Consumer Reports researchers uncovered a couple of problems with doorbell cameras. The ones sold by retailers like Amazon or Walmart or Sears, talk about what they found.
Yeah, what was found is a variety of kind of lower cost cameras, one that were actually being resold under a variety of different names. So instead of just having, let's say, a Nest camera or a Nest camera phone, which we see is a very popular option for most people looking at a doorbell camera, you could see half a dozen different options that were going under a different name that looked like a different company, but were actually the same doorbell. The primary issue is actually due to some of the security flaws with the technology itself. Most of these video doorbells, you have to use a smartphone application. So you install an app, it allows you to interact with your doorbell. You can see the video from your doorbell as well. But one thing that they found with a lot of these lower cost options is if anyone downloaded the app on their phone but was close enough to your device, they could pair that device with their phone, locking you out of access. And then all of a sudden they had access to the video content and could control that doorbell camera. So it allowed, you know, somebody else to have access to videos, take over control of it. It did require some, you know, closer physical access, but a lot of this was just due to kind of the lack of controls put in place to limit how people could kind of take over those devices. And unfortunately, since they're being resold as a variety of different cameras with a variety of different names, it makes it a lot more challenging to understand what are the differences between those and which ones are riskier, because it does look like they're distinctly different devices, but they're actually the same.
We have a list, I think it was from the Washington Post, a list of faulty doorbell brands. It's linked to the episode notes for today's show, ideas@wpr.org/Larry, so people can take a look at it. If you have a doorbell camera, how can you tell if it's keeping your data secure?
And That's an excellent question that's really hard to answer. So most of the services that we purchase, especially if they're using kind of a third-party company to either host or process the data, that data has to go somewhere. So you can view it on your phone, or you can view it from a different device. A lot of the older devices required you to have your own storage at home. It required certain access that really means it wasn't shared with anyone else. But when that data is shared with a third party, usually if you're able to view something on your smartphone remotely, when you don't have to be at home, you don't have to be at your home network, what that means is somebody else is making sure that data is available to you. When they do that, there's also the risk that data could go somewhere else. Maybe the company could use it in a different way, or someone might be able to access your account to get access to that data. So it's likely that if you're completely remote and you can see the content, there's the possibility somebody else can see that content as well. And so that in itself is a risk. And one of the best ways to protect against it is if you don't need to collect certain data, don't collect it. So with video doorbells, the challenge is a lot of them are looking at video all the time, not just when somebody rings the doorbell. So it's capturing a lot of the video and audio that might be on the street that, you know, no one's really consenting to, no one may be aware of, and that might be, you know, getting shared or used in other ways. So finding ways to turn those things off when you don't need them and turn them on when you do can limit the data being shared. But I'd also take a look at the companies that you're deciding to purchase a product from. Usually, and this isn't always true, but usually the more money you pay, you also pay for a little bit extra security. Maybe you are paying for a little bit more privacy, but especially in the case with these lower cost cameras that had these vulnerabilities, you're less likely to hopefully run into those issues. So that's one way to really help protect yourself. Purchase from reputable companies, likely companies that you heard of. It doesn't mean that a company you've heard of and that's popular is completely secure, but it does give you a little bit more extra knowledge that there's more oversight, even if it's not 100% perfect. So you know that they're trying to do at least some of the things to protect your information. I'd also recommend for any company, while it's a lot, look at their privacy policy. Hopefully they make it really short and easy to digest, which is challenging because a lot of those are hard to read. But the biggest thing I take a look for is, are they sharing my data with somebody else? Yeah. If they are sharing, what does that data look like? And so that's the other piece I'm really interested in, is how is that data being shared? Who has access to it? And what control do I have as a consumer to say, don't share that information, or make sure at least maybe I'm not paired with that information.
Are there some keywords that you might look for in the product descriptions that hint at how secure a device might be?
There are. So a lot of times you can find certifications that speak to the different frameworks that they might have used to test their devices. It could be through third-party auditors, but usually you'll see them as kind of seals in terms of, it's not really a seal of approval, but they've went through the steps to validate, hey, this is, they're doing what they say they're doing, and we've at least audited to make sure they're doing those things. They could be, they tend to usually be a lot of acronyms. And so it can be hard to kind of go through it. But I would look for any of those third-party accreditation labels that they might put on there. They could be SOCs or SOCs, or they could be other auditing bureaus to give you a little bit more assurance in terms of how secure it is. They might just say, we comply with, and it could be privacy laws or a lot of other things too. So privacy tends to be a lot more popular, which is a good thing in terms of making sure that the consumer is being protected. And so look for language that's talking about, we meet or exceed the requirements for different privacy laws, whether that's GDPR or that is CCPA for California. and we'll see probably a lot more acronyms in the future. But it's not perfect, but it gives you at least, you know, they're trying to compare it. They're trying to analyze it with what are other people doing and what are some best practices and standards.
Lisa sent us an email with these Ring doorbells. Is it true that police departments can request doorbell camera footage from users?
Yeah, and there have been instances where information has been requested and they have been given. A lot of that is changing depending on the provider. And I think Ring specifically, there is some information about them changing their policy in terms of what data they would share and what data they wouldn't share. Primarily, and this is kind of the challenge too, and this comes up as a privacy concern a lot, especially in public areas. If you're in a park and you take a picture, is that a public space, a private space? If there's somebody else in the picture, do you need their consent? And in a lot of cases, you know, if you're taking a picture, you're in a public area, you probably don't need any consent. When you look at a doorbell, it might be similar. So I talked about looking at the street. Well, that's a public area. Yeah. If somebody, when you look at like the Google Street Views on Google Maps, all of that information is publicly available. Can you request some of that information to get removed after the fact? You can, but it tends to be a really complicated and long process. So I think that's part of the challenge with those doorbells is what they're recording is what you could see if you're just walking down the street. So really, is that a privacy violation due to, you know, what we consider kind of a public space? And so obviously I'm not a lawyer, but a lot of those pieces kind of raise that question. If by walking down the street, you can see the same thing, is there extra protection on the content that's available from the doorbell? And we'll likely see those, that data sharing change over time as there is more conversations and especially court cases to determine, you know, where does that privacy line exist and what data should or should not be shared.
Yeah. David in South Milwaukee has a totally different question. So let's go there. David, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jesse. Thank you so much for appearing and helping us, so many of us in computer land here, Jesse. I really appreciate it. I have a question about Chromebook and streaming radio programs. I often enjoy streaming radio programs that occur during the day, but they do not offer a download function or a podcast, and I like to record those. I guess I'm using the wrong term, maybe download that program to listen to it at a later time on my Chromebook. Can you tell me the steps I need to do that, or do I need a device for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in a lot of cases, you may only be able to get the information live and there might be a challenge with recording it. What I would normally look for is most streaming services will have an option so you can download or listen to content when it's not live. So for example, this program, you can go on and actually view it or listen to it at a later date. What I would look for is probably more podcast applications. Podcast applications generally do allow you to download content offline and listen to it at any time. So you don't necessarily need to have internet access, but you can also subscribe and download previous series, previous episodes, and then listen to that. Usually that's what I do for most of my content. When I want to listen to it, it's going to be kind of a podcast specific application. For Chromebook specifically, I think you could probably use the Google podcast app. I've used that. I used to use different ones in the past that kind of changed. But that one, if your programs are in that application, you can hopefully download them and look at them at a later time. Not every different broadcast may be there. And so you might want to go to the specific location you're interested in listening to. They either might have their own app or they'll list, these are the services that we work with where you can get our episodes and download them. So that's what I'd probably look at is I would probably just look for like a podcast app because you'll find so many different programs that are being streamed. You can also automatically download for offline viewing or listening. And you can also get like good notifications. So you can actually have them just ready for you to play right away in the morning when you wake up.
Yeah, there you go, David. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Our technical director is Trina LaSousa. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're getting a tech update today from Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Great to have you listening in today. Larry Mueller here. Give a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's talk about push notifications for a minute, Jesse. Those are the dings you hear when you get a text, an email, or maybe some timely update on your phone. But before they get to us, those messages have to travel over Google and Apple servers. How private are push notifications?
Yeah, and I'd say the push notifications are probably just about as private as most of the other data we're sharing on Facebook or other social media sites. One of the challenges that recently arose is it seems like there was some data sharing potentially with entities like Facebook relating to push notifications in the government, which was a little bit different than, you know, sharing people's Facebook profiles, different messages, but specifically those push notifications, which is kind of a challenge. And it's a good reminder for really most of the technology we use. We're connecting to some third party that's hosting our data. They're hosting all of the content we're interested in. They're making sure we get notifications or other information, but it means they have the data. So it means that if they have it, they could potentially do other things with it, especially if they can read that information and make decisions on it. So with the kind of the risk of push notifications, you know, they can read the information. Since there have been, you know, recent occurrences of that information for those push notifications being shared, it can be kind of a significant risk to end users. I actually took a look at my own push notifications. I think they have like 30 or 40 different notifications you can get by push. And they include things like, you know, posts for specific people. They also include birth dates, events, and a whole lot of other notifications that you can get. And this is just from Facebook. This isn't including any other application. And so if that information shared, there's a lot of other potentially sensitive information that could be shared. I think more and more as time moves on, for example, we think of a date of birth as more sensitive than maybe we had in the past. We just thought about it as a time to celebrate one more year. But yeah. Now it's a data point that could be used to try to break into a system, trying to break into an account. Many times they might ask, hey, if you want to validate your account, please make sure to supply your birth date. With that information publicly available or it's easy to be shared, the security of that question is really, really challenging. So it can impact a lot of other things outside of just the data itself. It could impact other accounts or how people might try to access those accounts.
Yeah, you wonder. I guess there'd be a variety of reasons why people might be surveilling push notifications.
Yeah, and when I think about, let's say, Facebook specifically, one could be events. So a lot of people try to use social media as a way to gather, to communicate, either in person or virtually. If push notifications were, let's say, publicly available, well, that could give a lot of information to a lot of people in terms of who's at a certain location and what are they doing? What are they meeting about? What are they talking about? Because even if those events are private and only seen potentially to a certain audience and maybe even by invite only, if those push notifications about those events are given to those invitee only participants, other people might be able to get that. And so that's, you know, another concern. Things that were more private are definitely less private if those notifications are being shared.
Yeah, it's Interesting. What I would think, you know, an actor or actress or a famous singer or somebody who's getting married and, you know, sends out, you wouldn't be sending push notifications out if you didn't want a whole bunch of people there maybe looking at wanting to get to your wedding.
Right, right.
Well, are there any ways you can ensure your notifications are kept private?
The best thing with any to try to maintain any privacy is always consider what you share. So if you don't want it out there publicly, consider not putting it on Facebook at all, whether it's an event, whether it's a birth date or other information. For push settings specifically, you can actually change your push notification settings in, at least in Facebook, under settings and privacy and notifications. It gives you the list of all of the different kind of push notifications that are sent out. You can disable those either from receiving, but also from the individual notifications, whether it's comments or birthdays or events. You can disable those one by one or disable the notifications completely. That being said, the data is still somewhere, even if you're not receiving the push notification. So there's still a little bit of risk in terms of what could happen with that profile data or that event data. But at least from the push notification side, if that was the only piece of data that could be shared with somebody else, at least it would help address that risk. But in the end, if it's still in Facebook, if it's still in other social media platforms, there's still a risk that data could be shared with either less transparency or knowledge. And I think the other item to consider is it could also be broken into. So whether it's your own account or even one of the vendors, if they're broken into, that might give somebody more access to your information. So that can be a risk.
You know, let's talk about more things relating to Facebook. Targeted advertising is one that drives a lot of people nuts, including me sometimes. How can you tell Facebook to stop giving you targeted ads?
Yeah, there's a couple ways to do it. And unfortunately, they do tend to change these settings regularly. So new options show up in the settings and privacy all the time. But when going into the Facebook settings, they have ad preferences, and then you can actually go into a different ad preferences button. They have options for, one, you can review your ad activity, which you can remove, but they also have an ad setting with how much do you want shared with third parties. You can remove that information. Basically, the whole goal would be don't send me customized ads, and you'll still get ads. You just won't get ones that are more tailored either to the data that you have in your profile or your activity. It will be kind of more general, but it still may be tied to some aspects of your profile, maybe your location or other pieces of information. But that would be, my recommendation would be to unfortunately go into those settings and turn off any of those customization features, which should, at least for right now, help to limit those personalized ads. I think one of the challenges with a lot of the new settings that come out, a lot of those new settings are privacy related. They may not be using a default setting of privacy first, meaning that if they have a new setting that is about tailoring ads, the default will be turn on this customization feature so you get these customized ads rather than turning off that feature by default, meaning you do not get customized ads. So the vendors also have that choice of, well, when we give you this option to change, is it a default of off or a default of on? And personally for me, I'd say, you know, it should be, I should opt into that feature rather than opting out of that feature. So really going with that privacy by default.
I was laughing. I was thinking to myself, I get constantly on Facebook ads for a pan, and I had purchased one, and now I get, you know, every day practically an ad for that pan. Do I want to buy that pan? And I bought it 3-4 months ago. It just drives me nuts. And I want to return the pan. I'm getting so mad about it. Oh, boy. Tom in Buffalo County has a question. Let's go there. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Yeah, I've got a relatively old desktop computer, and I just wondered if I update to a solid-state drive, what type of speed increase do I get? I mean, one of the things that bugs me is it takes so long for the darn thing on startup to load everything. And I don't know. I'm looking at my computer, my stats right now, 3.10 gigahertz. It's a Dell Optiplex 990.
Okay.
So there are usually two options that are going to give you the best improvement in performance. If you don't have a solid state drive right now, that's likely going to be a pretty good improvement. Another item to consider is memory. So they kind of have that hard drive, which is storing really all your data. It's storing your programs too. They're just not running. Your memory or RAM, otherwise random access memory, that's where all your programs are running. That's where Windows is running. The more space you have there, and also the more speed, the faster things tend to run. So a combination of those two will likely improve the performance of your computer. One item I'd recommend, it sounds like you're running Windows. If you open up the Task Manager, which if you're on a Windows keyboard, if you hit Shift, Control, and Escape, it will pop it up. You can see how much memory you're using. If you're close to 100%, a little bit more RAM or memory would also improve your performance. You can also get faster memory. So depending on what came with your Dell, you might be able to upgrade that, not just with size, but with speed. But it's likely if you're using still a traditional drive, hard drive that is using what they call spinning disks. So it's mechanical. If you replace that with a solid state drive, you're likely going to see some improvement. But if it turns out you're also at that maximum for memory, you're going to have a little bit of a bottleneck there too. So if you can free up a little space in RAM, so you have free space for programs to function, and you improve the speed of that hard drive, you're likely going to see a dramatic improvement, assuming there's not some bad program in the background taking up some of those resources. So yeah, I think you'd get a good amount of performance from that solid state drive improvement, but also check your memory, because if that's maxed out, that's going to create different bottlenecks and slow things down as well.
Yeah, there you go, Tom. Thanks for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Sue emailed us. She's having all her photos stored on iCloud. However, on her iPad storage settings, photos take up over 11 gigs of the iPad's 32 gigs of storage. She's looking at her iCloud online to verify that all her photos are actually there. What's going on there?
Yeah, so it could be a couple different items on the iPad when you take a look at the settings. Usually, if you're using a lot of Apple devices, it will synchronize with your iCloud account. That'll include pictures, messages, other content. And so it could be really backing up all of your pictures. So if you have multiple Apple devices, for example, maybe you have an iPhone and you're taking pictures with it. If the settings are set just right, your iPad will start downloading all those photos, which means it's just filling up more and more space on the iPad. One item you can do is turn off or tweak some of the synchronization settings on your iPad. So if it is adding some of that additional storage with iCloud, you can actually turn off some of those synchronization settings, and you'll actually see in settings, and then if you'll go to, really, it's going to be your name in the upper left-hand corner, click on it, and you'll see an option for Apple ID. It will show you for iCloud, what's being synchronized, and how much storage it's taking up. So that's going to be really helpful for you to understand where those where that storage is coming in. But if you want to, you can actually turn off photo syncing with iCloud, which would hopefully limit the amount of data or at least new information that's being put onto the iPad. That's where I'd look first, because that's likely where some of that information might be coming through, at least if you're not putting on more photos onto the iPad itself. So I'd take a look there, potentially turn that off, and then you just might want to double check that, you know, what you're doing already, which is all my stuff on iCloud? Can I be safe if for whatever reason I needed to remove it from my iPad to save space? But check the iCloud settings. That's going to be your best place to go.
Steve emailed us. He and his wife are using StartPage as a private search engine for searching the web. And he was recently informed by the Geek Squad, that's fine. However, they suggested using DuckDuckGo or Brave or a downloadable search engine for privacy. Additionally, VPNs help with privacy too. What's the best setup for real privacy?
That's a good question. So there's a couple different options. One is how much data is being shared with my browser with other tabs. So I think that's one item that can potentially be a risk. So you have one tab with, let's say, Amazon open, you have another tab with Facebook. How is that data being shared offline on your web browser? If you want to be, you know, more and more private, one, I'd say use a really any search engine that doesn't have a lot more of your information. So I have a Google account, I'm signed into Google. If I have a Google web browser open, it already knows a little bit about me and can pair that data up. What you want to do is kind of broaden the amount of data that they can actually collect. I'd say using a VPN is going to be a good option because it will at least disconnect what your home IP address is or work IP address is from that activity. The challenge with that is if you have a phone, you have Google on it, you have Facebook, you connect to a VPN, and all of those apps are loaded, well, that VPN IP address is probably going to somehow get loaded into your Google data as well, because a lot of those programs will communicate even, especially on mobile apps. If you're using a standard, you know, desktop or laptop without those applications running in the background, if you want to be as, I guess, anonymous as possible, have no other browser windows open. Open up a private browser window, and it could be DuckDuckGo, it could be StartPage, or it could be Brave. Also, use a VPN, which makes sure that your home IP address is not being paired with it, and only use that connection for browsing at that time, and don't use any other services. When you use any other services, it's data that can be called back to you. That being said, if you are using a Mac, you might have iCloud. Well, that's always communicating back and forth. If you have a Windows device, you might be using a live ID, which means that you're actually signed in using your online Microsoft account to your desktop or laptop, which also gets back. So it's getting harder and harder to actually browse completely anonymously, because you usually have something in the background trying to communicate with something. If you really wanted to be completely offline, have a dedicated device that's not connected to anything, maybe it's running Linux because you might not have a live account, or create a local account that's not paired with Microsoft services, Google services, or Apple services. Because most of, you know, whether it's Chromebook, Windows, or Mac OS, they have features in there that tie back. So you just keep on peeling away pieces and pieces until you can see if they can't find anything. But if a VPN is going to be helpful, it's still going to help reduce the pairing of the information in private browser windows or incognito windows are going to be a good idea. And then just make sure you have less stuff running in the background, because some of that stuff running in the background may have your information, may pair you with using a specific service, which in the end could pair with other bits of data, which can be a little bit more challenging. If I really wanted an easy way to do it, I would say look into virtual machines. It's like having a virtual computer. If you're really interested in it, you can dive in. There's a lot of great stuff to learn about. But if you're on a virtual machine, you can control everything in the virtual computer, use a VPN in that virtual computer, and use a browser that's otherwise pristine and untouched in that virtual computer. And it can completely, well, hopefully completely, separate what you're doing on your normal computer with this other browsing computer. And a lot of people will do that because they do want to make sure that information is more anonymous. And you can also find really great features where if you have browsing activity, you know, anything you do on your computer saves something somewhere. With a virtual machine, you can also do something like create a snapshot, which is like a picture. This is my pristine computer with like nothing being done on it. You can take a snapshot, do all your things, revert to snapshot, and then you start from a pristine computer again. So it allows you to be more anonymous, but also maintain kind of a very clean, pristine environment. And a lot of people do that for testing, for technical testing, but it can be really useful for, you know, safe browsing or just making sure that nothing bad happens. Another reason I really like thinking about that route is if you are concerned with malware, you could run Linux, and most of the malware you might download will either be browser-based, might even be Windows-based. But once again, if it does get infected, even revert the snapshot, it's not infected anymore. So that virtual machine idea, I'd say that's that'll be a good, you know, good weekend, good couple of weeks to learn about it. But you can do a lot of really interesting things pretty inexpensively. And there are free products you can install on Windows, Linux, or macOS to actually create a virtual machine that doesn't require additional money. You just need the resources on your computer to make sure it functions. And then you can really try to go anonymous, at least closer.
Closer, anyway. Amy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I have an electric desk, and I'd like to be able to use it to stand up sometimes, but I have everything except my keyboard wired to the CPU. And I want to know what you would recommend for a wireless monitor and the kind of system to attach it to. Do you use a clasp that you attach to the desk? There are these different setups, and I don't know, you know, which to choose.
Oh, that's a good question. So, I've never actually used a wireless monitor in the past, although that's an interesting idea. There are adapters you can get depending on the version of monitor and computer that you have. So that's probably going to be one of the more challenging items. A lot of the adapters being sold, at least for like wireless monitors, are using an HDMI adapter, which is pretty standard. You see it on most TVs, you see it on most computers these days. But if the computer or the monitor are significantly older, it may not have that option. So that could be a challenge. One thing I've done in the past for kind of moving or standing desks is get longer cables, because you can actually get extender cables for USB and for video. So you can make sure that when the desk does rise, you have enough room. It's not going to catch on anything. It's not going to pull the desktop. And you'll have enough room to move that desk up and down. That might actually be the least expensive way to address it, yeah, is just to get extension cables for USB and for your video. You may need a longer power cable for your monitor, depending on where your power is. But I would look at that route because it's probably going to be the cheapest. Otherwise, an option I would consider for a standing desk. You might consider, if you don't have one, a power strip for the desk itself, meaning that you're actually plugging all your items into the desk, at least for everything on the, you know, that's going to be sitting on the desk. It'll probably be more useful, especially for power. But you still have to worry about everything coming from on the desk and plugging into the desktop if it's on the ground. Another option is you can actually mount the desktop onto the desk. Either on top, setting it on top, but I've also seen units that you can actually mount it underneath, meaning that everything comes up and down with the desk, rather than you needing to worry about the cables, the lengths, or doing a lot of wireless technologies. So you kind of have three options. One, try to go completely wireless, it's probably going to be one of the, if not the most expensive option. And it might not be compatible with the monitor or the computer if it's using older video technologies, but you can get easily wireless keyboard adapters or mouse adapters or wireless keyboards and mice. But once again, then you're spending more and more on equipment. Two, just get longer cables. I think that's probably going to be the cheapest option. And you can get extender cables for video and for USB and for power, which are likely going to be the three items that you need. The power cable for a monitor should be standard. That should be pretty good to get, especially if it's 10 feet. Otherwise, maybe mount that computer to the desk or set it on top of the desk. And then you just really have to worry about those power cables if you're plugged into the wall and how far away they're going to get. Those you can get power cables for. You can get really, really long if you need to, but those you can also purchase online. But I'd say looking at the cable options, probably going to be your most cost-effective route.
There you go, Amy. Thank you so much for calling. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio.
From missing husbands to murderous stepfathers, unsolved mysteries lurk around every corner in 19th century England. But luckily, his powers of deduction and logical reasoning are unmatched. Join us for five stories about the most famous detective of all time when Ken Ost reads from The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, today at 12:30 on Chapter a Day.
Today on Central Time, private equity firms have bought up newspapers all over the U.S. and cuts and closures have followed. Find out more with the author of Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Helped Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. That's today on Central Time.
You're part of WPR's community of listeners. Now join our community of members, people who support the programs they value. Become a member with your gift of $10 a month or $120. More than 50,000 individuals and families who donate make up the largest piece of our funding, so your support of any amount really makes a difference. It all starts with your gift right now at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Wollersheim Winery and Distillery, offering a variety of family-crafted wines and spirits. Wollersheim is a WPR Business Cornerstone sponsor, providing innovative, multi-year funding for future programming.
Stay connected with the WPR app on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. It makes it easy to listen to WPR live and read recent news stories. You can also hear WPR programs on demand. WPR is everywhere.
Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at technology with Jesse LeGrew, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Join in, number to call 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Esther in Grays Lake, Illinois. Hi, Esther. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question. I will be in the market shortly to purchase a home computer. I haven't had my own in years because, I'll be honest with you, I use my work computer to do everything, and I'll be retiring soon. So I'm wondering that when I look at some of the computers available, I mean, the price range is so wide and all the different options, and I'm wondering what would be the, for basic, what should I be looking for? I don't do really anything more than pay my bills, you know, do some Amazon shopping and Facebook surfing and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and emails. Yeah.
Well, first, happy retirement. So that's very exciting. For basic day-to-day usage, I'd probably consider a couple items. One, do you want to be able to take it with you or do you want it to be stationary? So if you want something that is good for basic day-to-day usage and you can take it wherever you want, has a decent battery life, I really would probably consider a Chromebook. Google Chromebooks are pretty inexpensive. You can get one for a few hundred dollars and it's going to do most of the stuff that you're interested in. It does usually, if you don't have a Google account, you'd be creating one. but it can be a really easy option just for basic usage. And you can save files to it and store it in different locations. If you're a heavy Google user, I think that might be a good place to go because it does keep you connected with everything else as well. Otherwise, if it was to be a desktop computer, you can still actually use a Chromebook. You just plug it into a monitor. You buy a monitor for it, and you can do a keyboard and mouse. Otherwise, I've been really happy with a lot of the micro PCs that are out there. And the micro PCs are really just small, ultra small form factor computers that are probably a little bit bigger than a stack of coasters, maybe two or three times that size, but relatively small computers. You just need to plug in a keyboard, mouse, and a monitor to it. And you can get those micro PCs from anywhere from, $100 or $200 to, you can spend a lot of money on one if you really want. But I'd say for about, $400 or $500, you can get a really good computer that's actually going to last probably for at least 5 years, if not longer, depending on your usage. It will come with usually Windows, or it'll also come with Linux. So if you do look at one and you don't want to use Linux, just make sure it doesn't come with Linux. You will see what version of an operating system it comes with. But I've been extremely happy with those, both for kind of creating technical apps, but actually setting one up for my mom and other people in the past. It's been a really great option and cost effective. And you can plug it into even multiple displays. You can have full wireless networking, Bluetooth, everything kind of comes with it. So those can be really, really low cost options. They don't take up a lot of space and they're not too noisy. So I do recommend looking into those, and you just look up micro PCs. There's a lot of different manufacturers that make them. Intel makes them, and a lot of other places will make them. You can probably get a good idea if you go into a store that sells computers that also has them on display that you can kind of see. But if you're looking for lower cost, I would consider one of those micro PCs or a Google Chromebook. Otherwise, you can probably get another form factor outside of the Google Chromebooks that are going to be good for a laptop. It's going to be a little bit more expensive, though. It's going to be probably 2 to 3 times the cost, which is why I kind of look at that Chromebook for day-to-day usage.
Yeah. And then with a monitor, I mean, the Chromebooks are kind of small. If you want to, if you're older and you're high.
Yeah.
Speaking for myself here.
Yeah, and they have at least some Chromebooks that get about 14 inches. 14 inches is okay. I tend to prefer like 15.4 inches. It's a little bit bigger, but it's also a lot heavier too. So just depending on what you want. Once again, I think most stores that are going to sell computers, you're going to be able to look and touch and pick up a Chromebook or another laptop to see whether you like it. But if you don't care about the laptop, you can get one of those micro PCs too that is going to be a more full-featured operating system that allows you to install different applications outside of what might be on the Google Play Store. But you can find some, you can find some really good options out there.
Esther, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oscar emailed us, what are your tips for finding a reputable computer repair person, one that would respect your personal information, I think is the main thing.
Yeah, normally I would recommend going to larger companies that hire, more staff, because that is also going to make sure that they actually go through certain processes. So if I'm concerned about bringing my device into an area for them to repair my device, and I'm concerned, are they going to look at my data? What are they going to look at? Going to at least a larger store that offers repairs, they're likely going to be doing more due diligence on their staff. They might be doing background checks, training, and a variety of other things that help to not only make sure they know what they're doing, but helps to safeguard the data and the equipment that are coming through their areas. That's likely where I would go. I'd want to go to a larger area that has a little bit more process around how they manage and intake employees and how they train them. You could also go with smaller organizations, but there's just more of an unknown in terms of what they do and how they do it, unless there are some out there. And I've seen this where they say, here are the three technicians that work for us, here are their backgrounds, and here's what they've done in the past. Some are very transparent about that. Some are not at all, because a lot of employees don't want their information just publicly out there. And so it might be a little bit different. But really, it's how much trust do you get from the data they give you, that they're going to have qualified staff, that they protect your data, and you know that they do make sure that the staff are trained and have background checks. You'll probably see that also in, you'll get an idea when you go into a store and you have a form that you have to fill out in terms of servicing computer. They will usually have some legal language in terms of what they can or cannot do, and what they may or may not do with your data. So whenever you have something like that, always read it, because it does tell you a little bit of what they may or may not do with that data, but also what they might look for, either automatically or if they find something that's unusual on the device they might check into. So take a look at the fine print.
Amy from Milwaukee emailed us, how do you prevent your phone from being scanned or accessed when you go into a store? It seems when Amy goes to certain areas in the store, she gets ads for items in that area on her phone.
It could be a few things. So normally I would guess it's going to be location services. That's going to be basically pinpointing kind of where you are geographically, which are really, really accurate, at least within kind of a flat store. If you're in different levels, might be a little bit different. I just go into airplane mode, honestly. Now, the challenge is if you want to use the internet, it doesn't help you because everything's disconnected. But that is the best way to make sure no one is going to target you for certain ads because you're in a certain area, is turning off all of those features, including cellular and wireless. Those are going to be two of the big ones. Usually Bluetooth or other technologies like near field communications or NFC, you don't have to turn off. But airplane mode, that'll do it.
That'll do it. Jesse LeGrew with us today, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. He'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We are going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here. And then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at technology on the show today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew. I'm Larry Mueller. Jesse's the Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College, where he works on strategies to protect the privacy of institutional data and reduce institutional risk. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions or comments are on your mind relating to tech? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jesse, how do you control who sees your posts on Facebook?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it is to look at, kind of similar to the ad settings, there is a location for privacy for the account in general, but also different activities, including posts. And usually they'll have three different settings. One is share only with myself. So if you actually want something you really don't want anyone to see, you just want it for yourself to review later, you can do that. Otherwise, you can usually do it with friends. Sometimes I'll have the option of friends, so another degree of separation, or with everyone in the public. Most of the time, when I actually use those settings, I'm usually using myself or I'm using friends, because I can control at least who I'm friending, in addition to, I guess, my own account security. So friends of friends is a little bit more risky because you never quite know if somebody does friend a fake account or if they're just friending somebody else that otherwise might want to get some information. And since we've seen, over the years, a large amount of fake accounts generated, I'm sure many people listening have probably even seen either from themselves or other people they know, that friends of friends setting can be a little bit more challenging. So always take a look at the settings. I try to take a look, I'd like to try to take a look more frequently because those settings change often. And so it's good to keep an eye on what new options appear, what you can kind of remove. But the privacy settings are really important, not just for posts, but for images or any other content that you take a look at or you share.
On the other hand, the other extreme almost, how do you, let me put it this way. I have friends, really good friends, who post, and I was getting those posts, and now I don't get those posts anymore. And there are a lot of people that I don't get the posts for that I want to get the posts from. And I have to go to their site, to their page, in order to see what they posted sometimes.
Yeah, and for in those cases, I guess that can be a good and a bad thing when you have less notifications about items that you need to take a look at on somebody else's page. One thing you can do is if you do go onto a friend's page, you might be able to kind of subscribe to different notifications that they're putting out there if they do have things you'd like to be notified about, whether it's for images or other posts. I've actually really used it the opposite way, where I've more silenced individuals because I actually didn't want to see their posts because it was just a little bit too much. But I would actually recommend when you go on the Facebook, they usually have the little three buttons in the upper right for the user. When you click on it, you have an option to also like show more or show less, which means if you say show more, you're going to see more of the posts that they offer. Show less, you're going to see less of the posts that they offer. But they also do have a follow unfollow option. It could also be maybe there is just an accidental click and you unfollowed. So you're still friends, but you're actually not following any posts. So I would check that for if you have one or two particular users, go to their account and see if that follow option is turned on. And if you go to one of their recent posts, you'll usually have an option to show more of these types of posts, which should hopefully elevate that for you to see it in your feed.
Ron in Manitowoc County has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ron.
Thanks, Larry. Jesse, I would like to establish a Facebook account only for Marketplace, and I'm wondering what security and who can view that site that I should set my settings at?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so if you're only going to be using it for the marketplace, which means no one really needs to see a lot more details about your profile, I would recommend, and I haven't created a new Facebook account in a while, so it's probably a good thing to try. I'd set up your account, share the minimal amount of information that you need to. They don't necessarily need to know your exact birth date or where you went to high school or those kind of items. You can leave all of that out. So I'd share the least amount of data as possible. Once in your privacy settings, I'd also recommend turning off, for example, personalized ads, also any of the other privacy settings in terms of sharing. I would probably share it with only myself. So in this case, only you would have access to that data. And then from there, at least it's hopefully pretty secure so no one can really get information about you or your profile. Whether you do or do not want a picture on your profile is kind of a personal choice. One item from the seller's point of view, it does depend whether you're buying or selling. So if you do see an account, if I'm going to buy something and I see it from an account that looks very, very blank, I might actually have concerns in terms of is it a real person or not. So that might be an issue if you're selling, but I think it goes around. It's the same the other way around. If you're buying, somebody might be, is the person trying to buy this from me actually real or not? So it's a weird balance. But I would just say you don't need a whole lot of information. You really just need to log in and to communicate with somebody. Just be careful who you're sharing other information with. But you need to find some other way to make sure you're kind of maintaining your data. And you're also, you have confidence in the person you're talking to that they're actually real as well. There are a lot of, unfortunately, fake Facebook accounts out there, but also fake marketplace postings and people trying to purchase things that are also fake. So that's why a lot of people, when they do make purchases or sell on Facebook, having some physical proximity or being able to meet in certain areas is kind of important. Because, you know, do you want somebody to know where you live or your personal phone number, all those kind of things. So all those will come into play once you get towards that sale. But I would say just don't friend anyone, don't accept requests, create your account, don't put a lot of information on it. But you might want to balance it to put enough where you still look real, because if you have absolutely nothing, it's going to be a bit more challenging. But you can at least restrict who can see details for the account.
There you go, Ron. Thank you so much. Let's go to Kevin in Madison next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about password managers. Are they a good idea? Are they safe? Can I use? I generally use Firefox, and I'm wondering if I can just use the one that's built into Firefox.
Yes, a good idea. So password managers, I'd say overall are a good thing for a variety of reasons. One, it's we can't remember all the passwords that we need for every account. I mean, I probably have hundreds myself. So I do recommend having some kind of password manager to maintain that information. One, so you, one, know all the accounts that you have. So it can be a great list of what accounts do I have where. But also it helps to make sure that some of those passwords can be unique. Because if you set the same password up for other services, it's kind of a risk. I usually don't recommend password managers built into browsers, and there's a couple reasons why. If somebody gets access to your device, they can. It's really easy to get all those passwords out. Also, if you click on a bad link, any kind of malware is installed that can also get access to your password manager. I would recommend usually. Something third party, so something not built into the browser. It may still be through a browser extension, or it may be a local application that you install. So I would personally look at one of those two options. The cloud-based options, you know, potentially have risk depending on, you know, how you're sharing that information and how that data is protected. There's a lot of great options out there that also offer protections like multi-factor authentication. Otherwise, if you wanted to be a little bit more, safe in terms of not sharing that with any third parties, you can install a local password manager for macOS, Linux, or Windows. I would keep it out of the browser. It means you'd have to unlock a central vault to copy and paste those passwords, but it makes sure no one can steal it from the web browser. And there's options like KeePass, PasswordSafe, and several others that are local password management options that don't involve sharing any of the information with a third party. I do use an online password manager, so it does synchronize with various devices. Is there a risk if and when that third party gets compromised? Potentially. So that's also an item to consider. But if you don't want to go that route, you can do it locally. Since you're probably using one device with Firefox, it's probably okay, and you may not need to be able to use it also on your mobile device or on a different computer. If you do, I would consider using kind of a cloud-based password manager that also has protections like multi-factor authentication, because that way, even if somebody has your password, they can't get into your vault without that other security feature. And there are good options. And actually, Apple and Google have their own password management options. I like to not have those tied directly to those accounts. So I tend to go to a different third party to use those password management services. But those are likely going to be giving you some better security than using the built-in browser options for Firefox, or even just the local Chrome password manager, because those are really easy to extract.
Yeah. Kevin, there you go. Thank you so much. Ellie in Eau Claire called. She couldn't stay with us. Has two MacBook Airs. One of the computer's monitors has gotten really pixelated with lines going down it. Would it be possible for her to use the other computer's monitor? Or is there a way to fix the other?
Yeah, so fixing the other one, probably. I'm guessing it's likely a cable or the LCD itself. If that is replaceable, you can likely go into either an Apple repair store or any repair location that's Apple certified that will actually be able to replace it. They'll at least be able to give you a quote in terms of how much the cost might be. So it's worth asking, if only just to find that. In terms of using the other laptop as a monitor, there may be a way with screen sharing, but I haven't done it myself. Because there is one, there's an option you can actually turn your old Mac into a hard drive. It's called Target Disk Mode. I think that's still available in the latest versions, although I'm not sure. I'm not sure if there's a similar version for sharing a screen, but you might actually just be using the screen sharing feature in macOS, but you have to be able to navigate it from the laptop that's having the screen issues, which might be another challenge. I don't think it's automatic. I think you still need to be able to navigate the menus to share that screen with the other display and then be able to pull it up.
Jenny in Onalaska emailed us. You always hear the saying, the internet's forever, but what does that really mean? Even if you delete something, is it still somewhere, and where is it stored?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a couple of different ways to look at it. One, you know, I look at it from the fact of, I have a, let's say I have a Facebook page and it's out there. It's out there forever because really anyone out in the world may have been able to view it, may have been able to download it. So in terms of where it is, it could be in anyone's home computer. That's really, I think, the question. We don't know where it is because there's so many different ways for people to save and store that information. But there's also different services out there, like the Wayback Machine, which is an interesting website to take a look at, archive.org. You can actually find historic versions of websites available on the internet for quite some time. So it's been out there for at least, you know, 20, 25 years. And you can find really old websites from a decade ago that are out there that they've actually archived. So that's one example of being able to find that information from quite some time ago. But the other challenge is you just don't know who else may have downloaded that content, where they stored it, and where other people might be gathering the information. And that's really the challenge, is for a lot of it, we don't know. And it could be shared in so many different ways. It's, you know, as soon as you put it on the internet, it's out of your control, because it takes one person to download that and share it with somebody else for it to be kind of out there forever.
Jessica in Barron emailed us. Earlier, you mentioned the servers that big tech like Apple and Google have. She says she may have missed it, but what actually is a server? Is it a physical thing?
That's a good question. So, in the end, a server is a physical thing. We talk about, you know, quote unquote, the cloud, which is basically just somebody else's computer. But a server is really just a computer, a little bit more specialized than the desktops and the laptops that we use as day-to-day end users. But it's a computer that's usually housed in a more secure facility that's running all of the other content that we access, which might be Facebook. Might be a web system where we access Gmail or another email system. But it really is, it's a computer, but it's serving content, which is, you know, really when you think of a server, it's serving some kind of service for anyone to take advantage of, or any consumer.
John wants to know, what's an easy way to transfer old pictures from Facebook and onto your personal computer?
What I'd probably recommend is they have the kind of a download profile feature in Facebook, which I've used, one to back up, but also to reconsider whether I keep my Facebook account at all anymore. But you can actually go and you can download your entire profile and archive it. That includes images and other data. It's going to be the easiest way to do it. Google also has similar features with their Google profiles. If you use Google Photos, might take a while to download it, but it's going to be the easiest way to just get all that content rather than clicking picture by picture. It's just to request that profile extract, and you can do that right within your Facebook settings for your account.
Have you ever ordered one of the photo books from Facebook?
I haven't. I've done it. I did it from Google once because I use Android and I take pictures through that. I got an email one day about, hey, do you want a photo book? I'm like, oh, that looks interesting. So this was, you know, the year in which I took these pictures. It was kind of interesting. I decided to buy it, got it in the mail. It was kind of nice. So I would probably consider it with Facebook, but I don't do a whole lot of posting on Facebook anymore.
Yeah, I did it, especially when daughter Emily was, has been growing up. It was, I had so many pictures, photos online of that, and I actually wound up getting two over time. And frankly, they're nicely done, I really enjoyed it. I enjoy having them, and I notice friends will go through those books, and so will my daughter. and it's been a lot of fun. Mark emailed us, are they developing anything that can tell whether an image or video is AI created?
Yeah, and there's been, a lot of conversation about AI, artificial intelligence, especially the last year, just with ChatGPT and similar programs. With people creating content, there's people that want to detect whether it's coming from a person or from one of these technologies. So the short answer is yes, people are developing them, people are using them. The downside is they're not 100% effective. Some of them are even far less than 100% effective in terms of determining whether it's one, AI generated, or even what generated that content. But since I've worked in higher education, it's also come up in terms of students and academic integrity. How do we know a student has generated their own content themselves or actually asked ChatGPT to do it? The downside is it's hard to tell, and you can't guarantee that it was actually ChatGPT, even if a tool says it is. So you really can't rely on a lot of those tools, because in the end, that's a student trying to get a degree, and you don't want to falsely accuse someone in terms of any of those items too. So the answer is yes, I'm sure the tools will get better, but they'll likely never be perfect.
Yeah. And just one final thing on the news. We had the midnight blizzard over in Russia hacking. Ever going to be able to solve this hacking business?
Probably not. So I think with any computer system, we're always going to have people that are trying to find ways around it. And they're always going to be able to find ways around it, mainly because, it's all constructed by people. We're all fallible, but even as we've seen with some of the AI tools, they're also they also have issues. So we're always going to have these problems. It's always going to be a bit back and forth. I think if we looked at it from sides, which it's easy to say, but it's more than just two sides, good and bad, or right and wrong, or attacker and defender. Each are going to increase their skills, and it's going to get maybe more and more challenging, but quote unquote, where everyone's really going to win, that's hard to say. So, I don't see it going any way. If there's an interest to do something, and usually that's making money, or it might be a political motivation. As long as somebody has a reason to do something, they're going to find a way to do it.
Jesse, always a pleasure. Thanks very much. And we will look forward to your next visit. Jesse LeGrew, our guest, Chief Information Security Officer at Madison College. Great to have you with us today. And stay with us right through the afternoon. Lots in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.